Paula Dwyer is one of New Zealand's most successful screen producers, but may not be all that well known here, as her most recent successes have been made overseas. In 2009, she produced the hit An Education, which introduced the world to Carey Mulligan. And this year, her film Quartet has proven once again that the older generation can still be box office gold. A couple of weeks ago, she was back in New Zealand visiting family, and Simon and I sat down with her for this wide-ranging conversation. Fionnuala Dwyer, welcome to Cinematica. It's such a pleasure having you here in the Cinematica studio, the Palatial studio.
It's a pleasure to be here. And this full table brings back memories.
That's right. Yeah, that's my vintage table.
That's gorgeous.
Let's talk a little bit about how you got involved in the movie business, basically. I was just looking at your credits on IMDb. It was the first port of call for any researcher. And your earliest credits are in the sound department of films, and so how did you get involved, and what made film something that you wanted to get involved in?
When I was at school, I was very keen on photography and set up a dark room at my school, which doesn't exist in Wellington anymore, the school. And when I left school, I tried to get into the film unit in the camera department, which is what I was keen to, you know, get into, and they wouldn't take girls, females then. So I started an arts degree at Canterbury, and then thought about it and thought actually editing would be, you know, an alternative. If I can't do camera work, then maybe I should go into editing. And that's what I did. So I was at the film unit for 3 years, worked with people like Sam Neill, and yeah, edited shorts, promotional films.
Tourism
yeah,
sort of stuff,
was great,
wasn't
fun.
It?
Yeah, really good fun.
The film unit in those days seemed to be almost the only way that people could work professionally in film, except for maybe advertising or maybe television. You know, were there a lot of ambitious people hanging around?
Well, I think the film unit, I don't know, with ambition in the film unit went hand in hand at that particular time. We used to have used to be out at Miramar, so I guess we're part of Peter's, Jackson's, you know, set up as now. And we had a editing house, a camera house, but the accounts house was in the middle, I think, to keep an eye on us all. But we used to go across the hill to Little Cracker Bay at lunchtimes in the summer and hang out there for a few hours. And yeah, I think we had a pretty good time, actually. But I remember they shot virtually everything on 35mm, and I remember thinking, oh, I should probably go and get some experience with 16mm at some point. So I ended up going to Television New Zealand and editing Country Calendar for a year, just because the film unit didn't really have much structure of deadlines or timetables. Right. So it was great, and you learnt a lot, and it was all about excellence, but you know, there wasn't any pressure much to speak of.
And we're talking about a period which we look back on now as being a sort of golden age of independent New Zealand feature film making, that sort of late 70s, early 80s period, where some of the classic New Zealand feature films are talking about. Were you watching those films being made and thinking, I really want to get into that?
Well, I definitely wanted to work in film, and my dad used to take us to the cinema a lot, actually, in Wellington when we were kids, and I'd kind of watch everything on television that I was allowed to or could get away with watching. And it was something that he used to do a lot with us. So I knew I really wanted to work in film, but it was, I mean, the film unit and television for a year was a kind of great combination, really, to just kind of get started in the business. And I was able to go out and shoots quite a lot, and I continued to spend, we had a dark room in the camera house at the film unit, and I spent a lot of time in there as well when I wasn't honing my assistant editing skills, which I'm sure I wasn't really the best in the world at that. But it was, yeah. So, and when I started at the film unit, Sam had just, I think, finished shooting Sleeping Dogs. Mm-hmm. So, and then he came back. He was directing at the film unit then.
Right. So, I didn't know that. I thought that Sleeping Dogs came about, and then he sort of shot to international superstardom pretty much quickly. So he actually came back to work.
He came back to to the film unit, and then he did Red Mole on the Road. I mean, pretty much then, you know, you could just come up with an idea, I mean, as the directors, and go out and make them. So the films that Sam was doing was definitely the more interesting ones. The Red Mole on the Road, that theatre group. And he did Flair, a ski trip, because he loved to ski. But that was a really great film. I can't remember if he did Surf Sail as well. But so he was making quite a lot of those tourist films. And then he went off to do My Brilliant Career, and that was the end of him.
Right, yeah.
as far as the film unit's concerned. Yes,
it was sure. all downhill from then on.
No, hardly. No, he was great. He was really great.
Mm. At some point, you transitioned into production, into being a producer. What did that entail in the New Zealand context?
It was absolutely just, well, not really exactly by accident. It wasn't planned. There was a film I had been offered to edit that I just didn't fancy doing. I'd just finished a long haul on a movie and was really feeling like I wanted to change. But I was sure directing wasn't for me. I'd done some second unit directing, and I just thought, I don't think that I have what it takes to be, you know, a great director. So I was thinking about what else, and then the producer and director of the film that I turned down to edit said, would I come and, you know, produce, be one of the producers on it? And I'm like, I don't know anything about producing. I don't, what are you talking about? And this producer said, well, you used to, every time you did a film for me, you would kind of go and renegotiate all the post-production deals, so the lab and the this and the that. And I'd say, well, that's because there wasn't enough money left to finish the film properly. But anyway, he recognized that he just thought I had good instincts about creatively, you know, finding a way to get the best and the most out of what money there was, and, you know, turn it into more. So so I think he just thought that was, you know, something which would lend itself, those skills and instincts, to producing.
What was the first film that you produced? What was the film you got a credit on?
Yeah, the first one I got a credit on was Queen City Rocker, which was a baptism by fire, let me tell you. 6 weeks of night shoots with pretty much non-actors.
There was a lot of production in that mid-80s period, because those are the days of the tax breaks, am I right? Was there a lot of money being funneled?
Larry Power was producing a whole series of films, and it was the kind of heyday of video, to be honest, and he could almost like raise the budget, or a big bulk of the budget, from doing a US video sale, especially if they were sort of genre-type films, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, and the days of Shaker Run and films
exactly.
like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I didn't have the pleasure of working on that one, but but they were great. You know, they were great films.
Battle Truck.
That's right.
They
I
were great.
That.
Yeah, that Wild Horses I did have the pleasure to work on, where the director escaped out the bathroom window when the producer was talking about cuts. So that was... we thought, oh, he's been gone an awfully long time. So that was very dramatic. And, yeah. Sorry, I've lost my train of thought. I shouldn't be too rude about these films. But they were great. They were great to, like, in terms of, you know, learn on, to be honest, and work out what you didn't want to do and, you know, maybe how not to do some things.
And how do you see that, like, in comparison to young people starting out now in the industry, and how that could be? Like, I get the sense that that's a lot more number 8 wire and a lot more sort of... I don't know, like just by the seat of your pants in terms of the way that it's done, whereas now it seems to be a
structure.
Yeah, I mean, listen, when I started, there wasn't much of a film industry, that's for sure. Mm. So the idea of even wanting to work in film, you know, when I sort of our career nights or advisory nights at school, it was just like, you know, they'd look at you like you were completely mad and just go...
Mm. And nowadays the Film Commission have career paths laid out for people. Well, there's that sort of you make a short, and that short goes to festivals, and you get a bit of name recognition, and part of what happens when they fund short films is that they're identifying talent that they think is going to be able to go through to making feature films. And I mean the Film Commission wasn't, its role wasn't that sort of career development then.
Yeah, no, we probably, in the early days of it, it was probably slightly, you know, made up as everyone went along, to be honest, I think. What I remember when I was on the Film Commission, which was the last couple of years before I left to go to the UK, so I was producing then, was that an industry's made up of many different types of filmmakers, you know, an industry isn't just, you know, Jane Campion and Vincent Ward, you know, needed the Peter Jacksons and, you know, who would have thought what he'd go on to achieve, which is just phenomenal. But, you know, those early movies of Peter, they weren't really necessarily what everybody always thought we should be doing. But for me, it was like an industry is made up of many different types of storytellers and filmmakers. And, you know, it's not, you can't, you know, it's not just one type of film. So,
You talked about, you mentioned just now leaving New Zealand and heading overseas. What was the path that you took, and what was the reason for leaving? Was it just lack of opportunity or?
No, not at all. My husband at the time, he was working in London, so that's why I went. It's as simple as that, really. I didn't ever think for a minute that I would go. And then when I left, I'd been, you know, I produced probably, I think I produced three features, or been involved in producing three features, and you know, Starlight Hotel, which was one of them, which was a great film to work on with Sam Pillsbury. And I was doing quite a lot of television as well, and it was kind of great fun mixing it up. I did Raglan by the Sea, which then, you know, led to Heartland, the Heartland series, and McCormick Country, which was the first successful chat show ever on New Zealand television. And we did two runs, and they wanted more, but they wouldn't really do it, I think, without me being there. So it was kind of fun to mix it up as well. And television has such an immediate audience, you know.
And documentary and as you say, chat show television, there's a whole range of stuff. There's no, you wouldn't get bored.
No, there was so much to do, and it was good to be able to, you could mix it up with film kind of quite easily, and then the money that you made from that would help, you know, you could develop stuff. And yeah, so it was great, actually. So it was quite hard to leave, to be honest, because I was really enjoying myself and having a great time and working with really good people, you know.
And what did it take to establish yourself in the UK? I would imagine it would be one of the most competitive environments possible when it comes to getting films made or getting...
And did the work that you'd done sort of count when you got there?
It was much harder than I thought. And it wasn't because I went thinking, you know, because I was being arrogant or anything. I just didn't really occur to me. I think I just kind of like, you know, move along through stuff and through life and what I want to do and just try and get on with that and not really think about the obstacles. So it was quite a shock to my system after having been so busy and kind of so productive to kind of find that it was the early 90s, and it was sort of Thatcher was still in, and it was like a very, very depressed country. And I remember this guy who
culturally
was actually
depressed as well as economically
everything
depressed.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I remember this American producer saying to me, nobody's ever going to give you a break, why should they, because most British producers aren't even working. I was like, oh. So I thought, fuck you.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm going to show you.
That's right.
And I did years later. Actually, it was about 6 years ago. I reminded him that he said that to me. I was like, and he's like, really? Did I? Yeah. I said, well, it made me all the more determined. But I was just like, oh. But what I did, and this is advice I often give to young writers and directors, is that I kind of looked for like-minded producers. So the people who had made films that I thought, God, I would have loved to have made those movies, I decided to target them. And I also thought, if I'm going to have a tough time breaking in, I might as well just like, I'll aim for the top, I'll aim for the best people, the people who have made films that I would have loved to have made. And that's what I'll go for. I won't go for trying to get into to television, or I'll just go for what I'm after.
So you started out by sort of defining what you wanted to be,
yeah,
and just being it. What do they say? You know, they say dress for the job you want or something.
Yeah. Well, I do. I think Australians and New Zealanders, or New Zealanders and Australians, I do think we have a kind of a great, just kind of work ethic and spirit, and it's that sort of new world versus old world, and it's good. I think it takes us a long way, actually. Yeah, if you've got that kind of drive. And Starlight Hotel had actually been picked up. I think Starlight Hotel definitely had distribution in the UK. And so that was a good, you know, that was something that was known, put it that way, which was great. And I had worked outside New Zealand as well on shoots. So that was also kind of helpful. I mean, I would say 90% of the people were very dismissive, and I've never forgotten them. And the You know, but people like Tim Bevan, you know, Stephen Woolley, Jeremy Thomas, who were all great, great producers, were all very, very welcoming and, you know, and kind of wanted to find something for me to do. And that's what happened. I ended up with Backbeat, which needed a lot of development. And, you know, and then that was the first film I produced there. And it was, you know, and it was pretty intimidating taking on, you know, recreating the Beatles, in all honesty. And I would sometimes just think, oh my God, this is insane.
It was a high-profile project.
Yeah, and then I just thought, well, what's the worst that can happen? And I always say, and I, all the time, it's like, I can always come back to New Zealand and do something completely different. Like, it's my that's my sort of escape kind of, you know, clause. Because I do think, unless you take risks, I mean, that's, you have to really, too.
As a working producer, how many projects do you develop that actually get to the stage where they're completed and on the screen? Like, how, what's your sort of hit rate? Do you have to have sort of, I don't know, a baker's dozen sort of sitting in development in order to get one done? Or what's the proportion?
We, I partnered up with Amanda Posey, who I produced An Education with. We sort of kind of formalized, joined our two companies up. So we try not to develop too much because I think it takes a Herculean effort to get a film made, any film. And if you've got too much, I just think there's not enough hours in the day to, you know, you just end up, I think, probably spending not enough time on anything. And that's the only way I can work anyway. Because I'm sort of an artisan producer. I'm very hands-on, very much a creative producer. I like the creativity and the business, you know, side. So do it all, really. And it's very time-consuming. So I don't know, I just have to feel very strongly and passionately about whatever we're doing. But some don't make it, or there's been too many films in that kind of, say, arena, or the script doesn't come right, and you park them for a while and either maybe come back to them or maybe not. Yeah.
How do projects come to you? Are you approached by people with ideas, or do you have ideas yourself that you then sort of develop?
A bit of everything, really. I mean, An Education came about because Nick Hornby, who Amanda's married to, and knew we wanted to, you know, start working together and find material to do. And I'd known Amanda really since Backbeat days because she worked with Stephen Woolley. So we go back, the 20 years I've been in London, and we've been kind of in and around each other's, you know, sharing offices for all of those years. So Nick knew we were looking for material. He read this little, it was an 8-page memoir of Lynn Barber's. And, you know, he said to us, you guys should read this. I think there's a film there. And then when we started talking about writers, he said, oh, I think I want to come and pitch my idea of how to do it as a screenplay. So that's how that one came about. We've just finished shooting A Long Way Down, which is taken an adaptation of Nick Hornby's best-selling book. And that was something that when I read it in proof, I really, really wanted to do. He optioned it to Johnny Depp for a few years and then decided actually after An Education to, you know, let us take it up, you know. So Brooklyn, next just adapted, which we'll shoot later this year, is an adaptation of Colm Tóibín's book, which, you know, I read and loved. But things come to us as well, like Quartet was sent to me at an early stage.
Let's talk about Quartet now, because it's still playing here in New Zealand after, you know, it's had a pretty healthy run and it's still getting audiences.
And up against some fairly fierce competition.
Exactly.
It's hung in there, it's done very well.
We want to break records.
Yeah.
That's my ambition. You can play it all year. I'll be back at Christmas, but we'll still be
check
playing.
On it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It should be an award, shouldn't it?
Well, yeah, if he's happy to come out and do a world tour to do a Q&A,
yeah.
then I'm sure we could keep it on until he arrives.
You could do one of those cinema link ups. He could do it from LA.
We would be absolutely,
yeah,
would adore that opportunity.
Yes.
So Quartet, you say it came to you. Does that mean that it had sort of was being shopped around, that project? Or?
No, not at all. It was developed by the BBC and another production company, and the sort of main producer at that time had passed away, so I think the BBC felt it was sort of languishing a bit, and it was from Ronnie Howard's play. He had adapted it. Tom Courtney had said to him, who he did The Dresser with a long time ago, he said, why don't you do Quartet as a movie for me and Maggie Smith and Albert Finney? And so that's kind of how it started. And Ronnie had won the Oscar for The Pianist, and so the BBC were happy to, you know, stump up money for the screenplay. And they had put a director on it. Well, they sent it to me with no director, and then, you know, time passes and they put someone on it who didn't stay with it very long. I sort of came on and they got offered something else and they were off. And for me, it was about finding a director who could really bring something to it and kind of lift the material, make it very funny and very moving. And yeah, it needed, the script needed a lot of work. I mean, it was a great idea, core idea, but it was still, and I think Ronnie would say this too, it was still fundamentally the play. I hadn't moved that far on from the play. And I thought in the wrong hands, it could just be a bit dull. You know, it could be dull. And it's all about, once you've got a great piece of material, then you've got to, it's about casting the director is probably the most important thing that you do. So we met quite a lot of people, and there wasn't anybody who I felt a combination of, that I could raise the money on, because, you know, it's hard to raise, you know, £5 million or £5.5 million. And, or that I really believed would kind of, you know, their ideas would give the film what it needed, you know, lift that script off. And so that's how I got involved. And I, at the time, we were, my family, we were talking about, you know, homes for mum because she had early dementia, and just thinking, oh gosh, you know, why can't they be better? You know, just, you know, trying to be, yeah, like, why could they? Because they do tend to be a bit institutionalized. So although she has ended up at Sprott, which is wonderful. And also as chair of film at BAFTA, I was working with BAFTA Film. I was working with people like Ken Adam and Dougie Slocum, who shot all the Raiders of the Lost Ark movies. And those guys were in their late 80s at that time. And they were so inspirational and just still had, they were just so interested in everything. And
so much to offer
life.
Still.
Yeah, and I was like, oh my God, you know. And that was, they were very inspirational, and it kind of opened my eyes slightly to the fact that, you know, we do, as a, you know, a society, tend to sort of write people off after a certain age. I can't say 75 anymore because it seems so young, because Dustin's 75. But it's kind of, you know, it's true. So I think it just, when the script came my way, it was, there were themes that I was thinking about a lot and had been involved in from two different opposite kind of ends of the spectrum.
It's still a big leap, though, isn't it, to say, Dustin Hoffman, you're the one that should be directing this.
Well,
how did that come about?
You know, it was a very sort of left field idea. I was like thinking, because in a way with Lone Scherfig, the Danish director who did An Education, that wasn't an obvious, you know, idea at all. And we really liked her work and thought she could really, you know, and it's how they respond to the material as well. So you go, okay, let's see what happens. And with Dustin, he had seen An Education, and the DP of An Education, who I work with quite a lot, had shot Last Chance Harvey, which Dustin was in. So he rang John for kind of, you know, early January 3 years ago, and said, Lisa, his wife, and he had watched An Education, and they'd really enjoyed it. Wondered why we hadn't cast a Jewish actor to play the Peter Sarsgaard role, which we had a good conversation about. And but he said to John, oh, look, you know, I would love to spend more time in London. I've got my house there, you know, acting, directing, whatever. Find me a job. And when I got this message from John, I was literally, it's a Friday night, I was sitting at my desk, sort of looking at the director's list going, there has to be someone I'm not thinking of. And John had told me that Dustin wanted to direct, and, you know, we talked about it a bit, like about when we were shooting An Education. So I Googled him because I thought, I don't know what he's been up to, really. And then he was, at that point, he was 72. And I thought, well, Quartet's set in house. It's about being in your last act of life. It's an actor's piece. And I sort of thought there is a life imitating art in terms of Dustin, where he's at in terms of his career, having been really famous and the story. So I thought, actually, it might just really appeal to him. And great actors like Maggie was already attached, and Tom Courtney. So I rang John and said, you know what, I do have something I'd love you to send Dustin. And that was that's how it's, you know, started. So it was completely, I'm sure if I'd picked up that message from John and I'd been out at dinner or something, I might not have even thought twice about it. It was just really been at my, you know, the stars aligned really for, you know, it was fate.
Mm.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what that set was like with those, with some extraordinary talents behind and in front of the camera, all with enormous amounts of experience to bring. Was it like a masterclass for you, or was it, what, because of the nature of the budget, was it still a crack on, we've got to get our...
Well, you can you never have enough time in some ways, so it's we'd all always like more time and more money, that's for sure. It doesn't really matter what the budget is. It was amazing working with Dustin, and I should say when I sent him the script, and then when John sent it to him, and we first talked, and very much then when we first met, I knew we saw this film in the same way, and so that for me is the most important thing and the best lifting off point. And then he and I worked on the script with Ronnie, and Dustin and I would have like 3-4 hour sessions on the phone, and then I would do notes from those calls, and then go through them again with him, and then go through them with Ronnie. And that's kind of how we work, because Dustin was in LA. And not long after I approached him, he got cast in Luck, the HBO series, so which kind of delayed us a bit as well. But that's how we worked for quite a long time. So working on the script with him was a masterclass. I mean, he's got brilliant instincts, and you could just imagine all that knowledge and experience that he has. He's got great instincts. So I learned a lot. It was a masterclass. Really was fantastic working with him that whole period. And then casting as well. He casts in quite an unusual way, partly because he was in LA. And I got him to meet Lucy Bevan, who cast in Education. And he loved her. And he said early on he wanted to cast real retired opera singers and musicians for all the sort of background, if you like, because he thinks like the background's the foreground, you know. And Lucy kind of basically searched the country for those people. And he never really wanted to see people like read the scene in a kind of like audition in that way. He was much more interested for Lucy to chat with them. And if there was any interviews or anything like that, especially for sort of actors as well, he would, you know, get Lucy to find those. And he'd look himself as well, because he could see a lot of from people's character and what they were like from those interviews. That told him more almost than them like reading a scene flat.
Yeah,
I mean, it was really, it was great actually.
I saw him being interviewed where he sort of mentioned that it was tragic in a way because they'd had such amazing careers, but quite short careers. And sort of give them a sense of recognition in this was something that he enjoyed doing.
Loved it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And I didn't realise that this was actually based on a retirement. When I first looked at this, I thought this was... And that was something that I found a bit odd about the film, was that it just seemed a bit kind of unrealistic in that sense. But then when I did some research, I actually found that this retirement home actually exists.
Yeah, it did. It was in the documentary Tosca's Kiss, which was made, I think, in about 82. Verdi left his house in Milan to retired opera singers and musicians. And Ronnie saw that documentary and sort of thought, oh, I'm going to use that one day. I'll do something with that one day. There's an idea there. And that was, so that's where it all started. And up until quite recently, there was a musician's retirement home in London, just outside London. And there's an actor's one and there's a cinematographer's one. And I think we wanted it to be aspirational as well. You know, it's not, we're not making a documentary ourselves. We wanted to, you know, I mean, a lot of people see it and say, I want to check into Beecham House right now. And I think it's good to, you know, make films that are aspirational, that take what are real life situations for people and go, actually, well, why can't it be better? And, you know, and putting like-minded people together, like, I think, you know, in terms of opera singers, musicians, actors, it's good. It's, I think it keeps people's, that sort of the old use it or lose it. I think it kind of energizes older people if they have to be in a home to be with kindred spirits.
And even if you don't know the people that you're surrounded by, you've got some connection, and
exactly.
You know, they're not strangers as such, which makes a big difference, I think. So the film got made, as we know, and then it got and then presumably it had to be sold to distributors or to, like, what, how does a film like Quartet then make it onto screens? Did you pre-sell it? That might be Simon's phone vibrating there. Excuse us.
I should answer that. It's the wife, but we'll carry on.
It was put together in a sort of typical way for independent films, you have a sales agent that you kind of bring on board quite early, and they will pre-sale territories for you. I mean, I basically did the pre-sales transmission, who have it in Australia and New Zealand, and they had done an education. I'd worked with them on a few films, and they're doing A Long Way Down, the one we're in post-production on, and hopefully they'll do Brooklyn too. And the UK distributor, Momentum, I had worked with before as well.
So they came on board while it was still in pre-production?
Well, you need that to finance the film.
Right.
So you pre-sell some territories. You get, we had the BBC came in for television license fee and some equity as well.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-sales, a bit of bank gap, and then you generally need some equity as well. And found these really great Swiss guys. One had been child opera singer in the Zurich Opera, and they had lived next door to the director of, one of them had lived next door to the director of Tosca's Kiss. And Hanway, who were our sales agent, thought it was a very unlikely project for them because they were all these three young guys in their 20s. But, you know, they had seen Tosca's Kiss, and they had always wanted to do something in that arena, so it was a good fit, yeah.
So is the New Zealand market and the Australian market, is it common for films at this scale to be pre-sold to us? Are we big enough to justify
it? Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Australia is a very strong market, and it's good for pre-sales. I think probably because in education we pre-sold as well to transmission. And it can be, you know, yeah, it can be a chunky sort of number. Never chunky enough, but yeah. No, and listen, I think we're at something like $10 million Australia and New Zealand combined so far, which is pretty good.
Before we turn the microphones on, we were talking a little bit about Dustin Hoffman's paying close attention to how the film is doing internationally, and
yeah.
He was asking you about what the difference is between Australia and New Zealand, you know, because he's getting constant updates as to I think it's fantastic that he's so excited about how this thing's doing. It's like a new lease on life.
And he's very savvy when it comes to business, and it is a business, you know, to him as well. And it's important that he always said, you know, he wanted to make a film that people would want to go and see. He wasn't interested in making something, you know, for himself, some vanity project. He, you know, nothing gives him more pleasure than, like, when we were closing San Sebastian to screen it, have 3,000 people. We were in like a sort of a stadium. It's incredible. And our first screening in Toronto, and we had the German premiere in the Berlin Opera House 2 weeks ago, and it was 2,000 people. And it just gives him such a thrill. I mean, it's just, you know, it really gives him such a thrill. Yeah, and it is a whole new sort of lease of life for him, a new career. I don't think I can tell you what I said to him, the difference between Australia and
New Zealand. I'd love to know.
You can talk to him and ask him.
Yeah, I hope it was polite.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was, very.
So you mentioned that you've got a few more projects in the fire, but Quartet, it's still playing here. It's still opening around the world in new territories. Do you ever stop being a producer of a film? Do you ever let them go?
It's not about letting them go so much. There's just always constantly still things to do. We've got the French premiere in March, and then Japan as well. And Dustin's very keen to support the film, you know, in as much as he can. And he knows that if he goes somewhere, it makes a big difference. And, you know, he's huge in France. So for him to go, that can make a really big difference to the box office, and, you know, and the overages come. So there's good, lots of good, you know, business reasons for him to do it as well. I mean, it's exhausting, I think. He's not an actor in this film, but for some, you know, for director, actors to kind of be on the road like that. And you
like
know,
a rock and roll tour,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, lots of interviews and very, you know, same imagine, questions over and over.
And yeah, that's what I was going to say. I can imagine it's very, very repetitive.
I've seen
sort of clips of those of the junkets that the big stars do, where it's they do like these five minute interviews, and it's basically the same interview over and over again.
Yeah, no, Dustin likes to talk, and he's a good talker too. He's great. And so your 5 minutes is, you know, so you get, he'll do quality rather than, you know, quantity, which is really important. But he's such brilliant value. When we did the EPK interview, the electronic press kit interview, I think we talked with him and Kerry Brown, who's a New Zealand photographer who's worked with me on films for going back to New Zealand, and he's been in the UK for over 10 years. So he still works with me pretty much on everything. And he does the EPKs too. So he did the interview with Dustin, which was great. And it's the sort of Kiwi mafia that I kind of keep under my wing in London. And yeah, and it was a 3-hour interview, and it's kind of just like, it's phenomenal. It's you know, piece of history, really.
Wow.
I'm trying to encourage Dustin to write his memoirs, which has to be a volume because he's got so many stories.
I can just imagine.
Yeah.
Just, you talked about Germany a couple of weeks ago, March, perhaps March. Young people here in New Zealand, and I'm sure all around the world, are constantly bitching and moaning, frankly, about the fact that
it's a hot topic. Really,
it is. And it has been, on this show before. Is release schedules, and why don't all films all come out at the same on the same day,
day
around the world, day and date?
Mm.
Because that would just defeat piracy. They say that's the only reason that the young people go to the torrents is because we won't give them what they want, or the industry won't give them what they want. And yet it seems to me that for a film like Quartet, actually building as it travels around the world is a marketing strategy.
Can be important.
Yeah, and interestingly, how you would view something like VOD, where you might do a theatrical and a VOD release, you know, concurrently, which has been trialed on certain titles and I guess hasn't really worked as yet on some releases.
No, I mean, I'm not a big fan of it. I think then you just dilute your theatrical earnings. So, but I'm sure for some titles that maybe don't have, you know, big potential theatrically, because, you know, we have to keep on encouraging people to get out to the cinema and make it worth their while. And that's why you're set up so great, because it's, you know, comfortable. And I think people still do enjoy the, you know, the cinema experience with other people and, you know, being in that room. So hopefully, long may that continue, and home entertainment systems won't take over. But I don't know. I mean, the studios do quite a lot of day and date, probably for that reason. But I know China, we're talking to the Weinsteins the other day. Once it's out in certain territories, then it's kind of just going to be, it's like all over China. You know, they were talking about Django Unchained, which, you know, they're doing incredibly well with. The certain territories, once it opens, then
it's got to be everywhere.
It's piracy, right. Yeah, will be rife.
So, but would you, with a film like Quartet, though, consider piracy to be a concern?
It is, actually.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised. And I remember on an education, Sony had somebody permanently employed just to take down all the illegal uploads of it.
Sure.
It was everywhere. You'd be surprised. It's not, I mean, it isn't going to be like a Django, for example. But, I mean, Sony, I think it cost them millions, the level of piracy on an education. And lost revenue. So yeah, it really isn't to be underestimated.
Yeah,
actually.
You're absolutely right. I have this vision quite often of piracy being more focused towards a younger person's things than younger person's titles.
And not only that, but it seems to me, just having talked to a lot of these young people, what they do when they're pirating is that they'll download something, watch 10 minutes, and go meh. And so I think a lot of the piracy isn't necessarily films that people really want to watch. They're sort of collecting, or they're just sort of, it's there, and they're browsing in some ways.
It's fascinating, though, because we've spent a lot of time looking at release patterns, and in fact New Zealand leads the way quite often with a number of titles.
I was going to say, you get films here really early, I think we do too.
And it's a fascinating, and yet there is a culture here, or a sort of a social media babble that, or bubbling away that sort of says that we don't get
we're
things
hard
quick
done
enough
by. Apparently,
hard done
yeah.
by. But that's, you know, that's it's interesting because quite often the titles are released in the UK, you know, after us and things like that. It's fascinating.
And it's, some of it would be seasonal, wouldn't it? It would be about school holidays and things like that. So is this something, release dates and release patterns for your films internationally, are they pretty much dictated by the people who buy, who own those territories? They will then make a choice, or is that something that you have input into?
Yeah, we have input into it, absolutely, absolutely. And especially with kind of the types of films that I tend to make, the talent supporting the movie is important as well. So they can't be everywhere at the same time. So if they're going to come out, you know, to Australia and New Zealand, for example, like Pauline Collins came to Australia, Billy Connolly really wanted to come and just couldn't. He was touring, doing his show in America, so the dates didn't work out. But you can't have everybody kind of going everywhere at the same time. Mm. So, and for these kind of films, that bit of support from the talent is really, really helps, you know.
Yeah, I must admit, that's one thing that I always look across the ditch with envy, you know, the number of titles that go through there where the stars are there, you know, they go into Sydney, they go into Melbourne or whatever, but they kind of back up their films with these campaigns, but we just don't quite get that level of support.
Yeah, well, it was just, I mean, you know, as I say, Carey Mulligan was very happy to come to New Zealand, and I think Pauline would have as well, so that's something I need to work on the distributors more.
Yes, please.
Well, and I must admit that I do like that idea of doing these things electronically if necessary, if that makes life easier. Certainly, when we've done Q&As here at this facility, they've been really well supported by audiences, and they don't necessarily have to be, you know, in person. They could be done virtually these days.
We did Momentum, and they first did it on King's Speech with Colin Firth, actually, about 3 weeks into the run, and had good success with it. And so we did it just prior to our release. We did a filmed Q&A with Ronnie the writer, Pauline, Billy, Tom Courtney, me, Sheridan Smith. Dustin was back in the US, you know, doing stuff for Weinstein's. And it was filmed out to, I think it was over 100 cinemas across the UK, which was great. And I think that sort of event will just grow and grow. And there isn't really necessarily any reason why then it couldn't be, you know, streamed to New Zealand, streamed to Australia.
Mm. Yeah.
The things like trailers that, I mean, you also would sign off on those and dictate the look and feel of them and that sort of thing. I mean,
I don't know about dictate, but we have input into it.
I mean, I go to a lot of conferences, and it's interesting. Like often we see a lot of trailers, but then also what we see are sort of just pieces of the film, you know, 5 minutes, 4 minutes of the content, which I have to say, you know, I often find more powerful than trailers, because they sort of, yeah, I mean, if they're right, I guess, but it's It's a crazy, I guess, in a way, but that sort of idea, given that we're in a digital world where it's so much easier now to sort of do that and say, hey, let's just have a little interview and then let's give you 5 minutes of the film. Does that thing ever sort of get raised or looked at?
No, that's interesting. And what we did on Quartet, we had, because Kerry Brown, in addition to all the amazing stills he did, he also shot lots and lots of B-roll, and we had so much great material, and he made what we call these viral trailers that got sort of released, and I think in some territories they've been more successful than others. And I think it's all about how they get put out there and then what you do to promote them. But it was a lot of, you know, Dustin, a lot of that B-roll behind the scenes, and just really great, you know, some of them were just absolutely brilliant. And you could see where Y Quartet was like it was, and where all the spirit, I mean, the spirit came from Dustin. He's infused totally across that movie. And some territories, like Germany actually started it, they put him into the trailer, which was really smart, and then Weinstein's kind of followed suit and did it as well, and it was great. So I think we had a lot of content, and we got a certain amount of it out there, but I think we certainly could have got more. And I think it's a good point. It's, you know,
well, it's just an interesting, I mean, I just think it's a trend. Is it something that is worth playing with? And if you know, like, because the digital medium gives you that much more room to sort of play, I think, than film.
And I mean, we do, like for Berlin, for example, on A Long Way Down, and we did it for Quartet as well this time last year, we cut like a 5-minute promo. So it's longer than a trailer. So maybe that's what you've seen rather than actual,
yeah, that's right,
like a chunk of the movie. Because it's all about giving tasters and teasers and making people entice them into seeing it.
And quite often online now, some films you'll see on the page of trailers, there will be like the first 3 minutes of a film or the first, you know, the pre-credit sequence or something like that, just to wet your whistle and get you interested.
Yeah, I think we've got to work harder and harder at making people, get to the cinema. But I mean, it's booming here and Australia and England, so
It's a great success, it really is. Yeah,
but people are coming to the cinema more than ever, aren't they?
I think they are, with the right offers.
Yeah,
you know, and for like a location like mine, for example, Quartet is perfect. I mean, it really is our sort of bread and butter. We look forward to two or three titles like that a year, and so yeah, I mean, it is perfect for us, and we keep playing it, play them out as long as we can. We have different models though to the multiplexes, which are a bit more sort of, they want to chew things up a lot quicker and look for the next one, whereas we try and play out as long as we can. But yeah, I think New Zealand is actually quite spoilt for. And it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on that. Like, I think the quality of some of the cinemas that we have around the place and the offers. I think that we're always constantly working on them and improving them and sort of looking at better ways to present films and improve the experience. I think it's fairly healthy overall.
Yeah, and my theory is that in addition to the quality of the facilities, the quality of the offer and what have you, it's a lot of the reason why New Zealand has successful cinemas is because television is rubbish. And so for people who like films like Quartet and films like that, there's not much out there for them on television.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But I think, I think TV nowadays is getting much, the production values behind it. And you look at the things that come out on the Soho Channel.
It depends how you define
like
television, I suppose, isn't it?
Right.
It's like if you look at the Boardwalk Empires and what have you, that HBO stuff, that's a different category to... I was thinking about, we missed that Sunday theatre. There was a big audience for that Sunday theatre where you got some quality British drama, and I think that a lot of what's successful in New Zealand is coming out of people wanting that sort of calibre of material. That's my theory anyway.
That's interesting. I mean, I think television here could do with a kick up the backside, that's for sure. I think it used to be a lot better, and yeah, that's a whole other conversation, because I am passionate about television as well, and I think they're not serving their audiences as well as they could be or should be, and it's really not that difficult, I don't think. So that, but I think, the cinema experience in New Zealand is brilliant, and people have talked about your theatre to me for, forever, I guess since you started it.
Oh, great.
People always say, that's the theatre to go to in Wellington.
Oh, that's very kind. Yeah,
but it's great because we had in London, there's Screen on the Green, which has been there for years in Islington, and Nick Hornby and I went and did introduced a screening there, a charity screening for in education, and Nick would sometimes, his office is near there, and he'd sometimes go to screenings during the day, and he'd say, I'll just go to support it, because he said, generally there's nobody there, and I just feel it's going to close down, and he kept talking to the manager, and I think, sort of basically was talking about, they were just starting cinemas like yours with, more comfortable chairs, and basically have less seats, but, offer more. And they did that and put in big chairs and a bar, and it's like packed out all the time now. But it was on the verge of, probably having to close. So, yes, he's got less seats, but he's constantly full.
That's right.
It's a much, much better scenario.
That's the future we look for.
Yeah, I think the UK was quite slow to catch on to that idea, but now it's, because you've been doing it. How long have you been here?
We've been going just over 10 years now.
Yeah.
And we've just opened more sort of locations.
Well, that's fantastic.
So, it's keeping us busy.
Do you think there need to be more screens in New Zealand? Think there's enough screens?
Look, I always think that it's like a looking at a film and a release date. I mean, there's lots of films there, but do you think your film would do better? And I think, we would take the same view. If we think we can offer something that's better and people will go to and support, then we would always look to add more screens. And I do think as an industry, you have to keep recapitalizing, you have to keep investing in what you're doing. Otherwise, you will get caught out and something will come along, whether it be the quality of, TV productions and so on. So,
or a massive technological change in the industry, and you're behind the eight ball.
Exactly. So I think the offer has to we have to keep reinvesting and offering more, and certainly if you keep doing that, then I think you're always going to be there or thereabouts. Yeah.
And with the sort of demise of prints, do you still screen prints here?
We do. Like, we in the new one in Wellington City, we've got three screens that are completely digital. But here we've got two screens that are digital and two that aren't. So we're still running film. And it is tough. There is a period of transition, and I think New Zealand is sort of, you know, one of the last territories to kind of completely convert to digital. And so the materials quite often aren't as easy to get now, like trailers, 35mm trailers aren't so easy to get, and the prints aren't so generously sort of handed out as they used to be.
And they've been around the block a wee bit as well.
And they have been, yeah. So on the whole, you know, I think it's a very difficult time because there are titles that you could probably do more with, but you've got to juggle the commitments of what you've got in terms of digital and film and where you put them and so on and where you can play them.
Does the DCP, do the distributors tend to leave it with you for longer, or do you end up, you know, do you own it, or do you have to kind of only have it for, can only have it for a certain length of time, like a print?
Well, they will issue a key, and so that key will unlock the DCP file. And we're certainly finding that there are lots of variances in the files, and there are little quirks, and that's all just part, I think, of the whole ironing out process. But and we are finding that key management is an issue. Like often we're getting keys very, very close to opening, and that's something that is a little bit frustrating, because there's no reason why it couldn't be there. Like a print would be a week before you open, and you'd get it, you'd test it, and if there's any problems you can deal with them. Whereas often you might be getting a key now that unlocks a file the day before a film opens, which I think is just cutting it too fine.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and I do think that there are some titles that, I guess it goes back to that piracy question, but there are some titles where I'm just questionable as to whether or not you even need a key to unlock it. You just need the file and off you go and play it. But
I've noticed that there are some distributors now that are even locking trailers in advance so that there's no way that anybody could see a trailer in advance of the US launch of a blockbuster trailer. And it's like even the marketing materials are being locked down now.
Is that for studio films? Or?
Yeah, it was for Superman.
Superman. Mm. Yeah, no, the US is quite protective about going first. It's always a big thing. They always want to go first. I mean, piracy is a big part of it, but they like to get to go first. And actually, On and Education and Quartet, Australia and New Zealand went ahead of the US, which is kind of funny.
So that's good. So it'll be our reviews
only by like a few days, but it was.
So I think the digital world is offering a lot of challenges, which we'll iron out and get, you know, sorted out over time. But it's interesting. I mean, I'm sold on digital. I think that the quality of the image and the sound that you get on the screen is fantastic.
It's amazing.
And we used to get so many kind of, particularly with foreign language, we just get so many films that have been, you know, they're well worn before they'd get to New Zealand.
I watched a film on Sunday and it looked bloody awful.
Really? Yeah. I love film though. I mean, I'm a sucker for film. I've just shot my, A Long Way Down wasn't shot on film, and that's the first one, you know, kind of ever really. But it looks great. And yeah, no, I mean, going around the festivals with Quartet, with the digital, with DCP, has been really interesting. I mean, you don't have to have that anxiety anymore about, you know, sort of bad reel changes or them being scratches, you know, being incorrectly plated or whatever it's like. And then the Berlin, you know, premiere was in the Berlin Opera House, and they just put all the kit in the night before, you know, sort of all like overnight. And that wouldn't have really been possible if it had been a 35mm print. So digital's enabled that. And everywhere so far it's looked great. So
I'm a
convert, I have to say, too.
I am, and I think one of the big things for me is the difference in sound. Like, not just the image, but the quality of the sound that now comes through is quite a game changer, I think.
I mean, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, things like 3D and that, I think, are, you know, that's actually a sort of sideshow in a way. Like, the quality of the image and the sound now that we're getting is quite amazing. So,
do you think 3D is here to stay?
I do. It only works so often for me. Like, it worked with Pi. It worked to a lesser extent with Tintin. I thought, you know, that was an interesting 3D film. I like adult 3D. Like, I like Pina. I'm looking forward to Cirque du Soleil and seeing that in 3D. So I think for our market there is some interesting 3D content. I mean, Cave of Forgotten Dreams is another one. So I think those are really interesting 3D films, but I do think that we're saturated with kind of the more mainstream type.
Yeah, I think a lot of it should have not bothered, really. I still think Avatar's probably the best 3D.
It is amazing. Yeah. And I must admit, I remember looking at that going, oh, I don't know.
It is interesting, isn't it? And actually, the technically the best 3D that I've seen is actually the 48 frame Hobbit. It's like that's when 3D is the easiest on the eyes for the longest period of time. I felt like it seemed to me that those extra frames, the 3D that's benefited from those extra frames better than 2D would, or you know, that just that's
yeah,
that was my,
and I haven't managed to see it in that sort of pure form yet, but I definitely do want to check it out. I think Avatar was just more how the 3D was used, you know, in terms of storytelling terms, I think is still
well, and that was the and that was what was so special about Pi as well, was that it was actually used metaphorically throughout. It actually a great director using these extra tools to add visual elements to the themes of his story, and I think that's, you know, that's what we always wanted, was artists to get hold of the tools and start taking it in directions that you wouldn't normally expect.
Any ambitions to work in 3D?
Not really. No, I don't think so. I can enjoy it from afar.
Fair enough.
I think it's really, I mean, the cinematographers who I know who have, you know, shot in it, say, you know, like John Matheson, who shot Gladiator and who I've worked with, and it's a good friend. You know, it's difficult. He says it's very difficult to kind of like get it so that it looks really great and it's really effective. And I think he does work with it very, very well. So I think he finds a lot of the 3D is, you know, falls well below par of what it really could be. So I think when it's done well, I think it is kind of fantastic. But then you don't want to be sitting to the side in the theatre. I mean, I just think as a kind of a cinema going experience as well, you need to be sitting in a certain place to
get the best of it.
Yeah. But for some, you know, for some audiences, it doesn't. Yeah, they're not too worried about that there.
Finola Dwyer, thank you very much for your time and being a guest on Cinematica. We've really, really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.